The idea of really pushing back on the scientific community with the harm that cancer therapy can sometimes cause, Dr. Love was pretty revolutionary in saying this isn't okay and we have to find ways to do better and be better.
In this conversation, Dr. Stephanie Graff speaks with the Cancer History Project about the legacy of Dr. Susan Love's breast book, which was first published in 1990. Graff is the director of breast oncology at Lifespan Cancer Institute and medical advisor to Susan Love's foundation. Graff is also a contributing author of the seventh edition of Dr. Susan Love's breast book, the most recent version of the book published in 2023. I'm Alexandria Carolyn, Associate Editor of the Cancer History Project. What's the secret to this book remaining so vital that it has withstood seven editions over the span of more than 30 years? Graff walks us through how the book has evolved over the years, how she came to work with Dr. Love and the foundation, and the wide-reaching impact of the Bible for patients with breast cancer.
I'd love to just start with some background about when you first heard about Dr. Susan Love's breast book, and sort of what this meant to you at the time.
So I guess my first exposure to Dr. Susan Love's breast book was during my breast oncology sub-fellowship. One of my patients had brought it in and was like using it almost as her cancer notebook and had pages flagged and said, "Well, what about this? What about this? It says here." I thought that the insights from the book were just absolutely wonderful in terms of how it challenged the patient to think about their diagnosis and ask questions about their diagnosis. And I found Susan's colloquialisms, her sayings and expressions and examples of ways that she, converted a complex scientific topic into sort of patient-centered thought really aligned with my own. So I actually ended up buying my first copy after that and read it almost as an adjunct to my breast oncology scientific training, just that inspiration of a different way to think about how we communicate breast cancer. And there's actually a lot of interesting sort of historical pearls embedded in the book in terms of how breast cancer has transformed over the last several decades, which was interesting to me as a breast medical oncologist to read. And then it covered parts because it's a very comprehensive guide to breast health. It's not just breast cancer, it's survivorship, it's prevention, it's diagnostics, it's surgical techniques, stuff that's maybe not traditionally covered in a medical oncology training. It actually ended up providing some foundational knowledge on things that I hadn't known or hadn't been exposed to yet that allowed me to then dig deeper into the science side of that base knowledge that Dr. Love just outlined so eloquently in the first version of the book that I bought.
So you learned about this through a patient, essentially. And you talked about those really interesting colloquialisms and sort of sayings that Dr. Love included. Is there anything that really stands out to you that at the time you were like, "Oh, wow, like I didn't know this, or I didn't even think this before?" Or she kind of like put words to something you had been thinking?
I think that, the Susanism that I perhaps most intimately burned into my mind, which actually may be more of a result of then going on to work with her, is that the concept of collateral damage, that, if you're going to do any treatment and it's going to reduce your risk of breast cancer occurring in the first place or coming back later by X percent, but there's an associated risk of Y percent that you're going to develop numbness and tingling in your fingers and toes that leaves you disabled or cause you to have joint pain that bothers you mentally and physically every day for 5 or 10 years. Is the algebraic equation balanced for you? And the truth is that that's actually a really nuanced conversation that I'm glad I get to engage my current patients in. But the idea of really pushing back on the scientific community with the harm that cancer therapy can sometimes cause, Dr. Love was pretty revolutionary in saying this isn't okay and we have to find ways to do better and be better.
And is this, the concept of collateral damage? You mentioned that, you were kind of hearing about things in the Dr. Susan Love's breast book that weren't necessarily traditionally covered in your medical education as of that time. Is that an example of one of those things?
I mean, obviously, we talk about toxicity of therapy and the side effects of the treatments that we prescribe, but Susan just approached it in this much more assertive, patient-centered way that really empowered a reader to be able to sit with their physician and say, this is not a trade-off I'm willing to make, or help me place these two sides of the equation on the scale so that I can decide if that balance is acceptable for me. And I hadn't seen physicians previously be as critical of the negative side. And I know that you can identify with that as a science writer, and our audience can identify that with their interest in this topic by reflecting on every podium presentation you've ever heard, where we stand up and say that these side effects are acceptable or well tolerated, or these kind of buzzwords that we use that don't really break it down for what that might mean for a concert violinist who now has numbness in their fingers, or a patient who stands on a factory job for an 8-hour shift and now has such pain in their feet or their knees that doing that job is limiting. And so to really, be able to reflect on it in a different way than I had before was fresh.
Absolutely. And one thing I thought was really interesting is how you said that your patient had sort of dog-eared these pages and was almost using it, interacting with it like a journal of sorts. Is that something you've come across a lot? Or, I mean, I know not every patient might use it that way, but I guess what I'm asking is, like, why is this book helpful and useful for patients and maybe providing information for them that they can't find written in a similar way elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, so the sort of famous New York Times review of the Dr. Love breast book is that it's the breast Bible for women, the breast Bible for patients, honestly. And it, that very comprehensive nature of the Dr. Susan Love breast book is so unique. I've, now had the privilege to read numerous patient-centered breast texts, and none of them have ever been as comprehensive, as thick, as deep into the knowledge and the science as Susan's, work and subsequent editions and revisions of the Dr. Love breast book have been. And I think that that really speaks to who she is and what she believes and champions, hopefully what I believe and champion, which is really not to underestimate the ability of a patient to learn about and understand their disease from a scientific perspective. I think, Dr. Love became a physician at a time when there were not very many women physicians. She became a surgeon at a time where there were not very many women surgeons in a very competitive East Coast environment. And she rejected the idea that women are less than. And she extended that approach to her own education and her own career to the patients that she was caring for. It absolutely horrified her that women would go to the operating room not knowing if they had cancer and wake up with a mastectomy. And so the engaging patients in the decision around lumpectomy versus mastectomy, in the role of biopsy to empower a patient to have those discussions and make those decisions. Those are all hallmarks of her career and her legacy, you know, really involved in the San Antonio breast cancer patient advocacy from, you know, the inception. And all of those are just hallmarks of how Susan valued communication. And she really embedded that in the book. And so it's not often that patients pull the Dr. Love breast book out of their handbag, in part because it's huge. And so it's probably a burden to carry around with them in dog ear. I have actually said to Susan and to our colleagues at the Dr. Susan Love Foundation that I think we need a, you know, workbook or a study guide or the notebook version that is more portable for patients that are hoping to use it like that. But I do think that patients take it home and review it and dog ear it and transcribe their specific questions into their notebooks and their iPhones and whatever devices that they're using to communicate and reflect on their diagnosis with their care team.
That's great. You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about, you know, even like the use of iPhones and things like that. You know, when this book first came out, I think it was around 1990. How has the book changed and evolved over the years? How have you seen that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's changed as the science has changed. And think about how far we've come since 1990. In revising this edition, one of my, you know, key values is that Susan is a breast surgeon and I am a breast medical oncologist. One of the other advisors is a breast radiologist who contributed to the newest edition. And so we each sort of had our brainchilds in this edition and revising the chapters on everything from endocrine therapy to chemotherapy side effects just from the sixth edition to the seventh edition. It's fundamentally different. Like the way we treat, the drugs we use, the thinking and the approach to, you know, neoadjuvant chemotherapy before surgery versus adjuvant chemotherapy after surgery has completely changed between those two editions. And so I found like there were just large sections that were just scrapped and rewritten because so much has changed. And I think if you go back to the earliest editions of the book, even things like sentinel lymph node biopsy or partial breast irradiation were not mainstream and were not a part of the routine care of women across the country or across the globe. And so just seeing that evolution, really seeing the science of survivorship and the science of supportive care change has been, you know, a hallmark from earliest editions to latest editions. And then I think another thing that's really changed is the inclusivity. You know, Dr. Love, it has been a champion for that. She, you know, I'm sure in her story that you've encountered, you know that Dr. Love was married to a lovely woman, Helen, and they were the first couple in Massachusetts to adopt as a same-sex couple their daughter, who's biologically their daughter. And that ended up in the Massachusetts State Supreme Court. And so Dr. Love has really been an advocate, not just in cancer research, but also in gay rights and parent rights. And I think that as her evolution as a advocate for the rights of others has evolved, the language in the book has also evolved. She's been very intentional about including women of color, including men with breast cancer, in the language of the text, in the way that those communities are thought about and included, and their particular needs and conflicts are specifically addressed in the texts, has evolved over that time too. And that's something that's really refreshing and powerful to see.
you mentioned these Susanisms earlier on. And I'm curious, does do you feel that the current edition of the book still sort of maintains that tone that she was going for in that first one that you read?
I hope so. And that's, I think that that's one of the things that Susan and I really connected about when I first joined the organization was just our passion for effective patient-centered communication. And there were times, reading the last version of the text that I thought, oh, like I have a great analogy that I use to describe that for patients, or I have a great anecdote, or that, description maybe doesn't resonate in our current culture as well anymore. We can find ways to update it. And I think Susan was very, very excited and enthusiastic about making sure that everybody's voice is reflected. But there are loads of Susanisms that persist and that are just so perfect. I can't imagine them being edited that continue to exist in the current edition. That of course, she carried us over the finish line and is definitely reflective of her intellectual work and value and concepts. And so it's just really cool to have been a part of it.
I'd also just love to hear about your own work, in contributing to the seventh edition and what your role was there and how you worked, with everybody on that.
Yeah, so Susan has a team of people that work on the book. And so Elizabeth Love, who's actually Susan's sister, is in many ways is definitely one of our co-authors, and in many ways is kind of almost a project manager, helping to kind of go through it and make sure that the references are updated. So Elizabeth is a hero. Mad props to her and all the work she put in on this text. And then Lauren and I, the other medical advisor, went through chapter by chapter and highlighted areas that needed to be updated, highlighted areas where we thought we would have a newer anecdote or a great analogy or story that would really put it in current context for patients as they were reading. And then helped with the rewriting of chapters that were relevant to us, like, Lauren with breast MRI advances and me again with chemotherapy and some of the supportive care contexts. And then, Susan is the final round of red ink, making sure that everything flows well and reads well. Elizabeth Betsy is also fluent in Spanish, so she assists with the Spanish translation, as does one of the third medical advisors to the foundation. And then this year there's going to be continued editions in other countries. For example, the book is being translated for China again, which is the first edition in a few editions. I'd have to look to see which the last one was that went to China, but that's really exciting. The Love CEO, Christopher Clinton Conway, is influential in helping work with the publisher and make sure that all of those editions stay true to Susan's vision. And I say, I think together, that team of people is really behind the scenes helping to drive the project.
I also just wanted to, I know we're talking so much about the book, but I wanted to briefly touch on, Dr. Love, the person. If you could speak to your own, friendship and working relationship with Dr. Love and how that grew over the years, and your involvement, how you got to be involved within her foundation as a medical advisor.
Sure. So a few years ago, the Love Foundation had decided that they were interested in expanding and having a medical advisor to the foundation and had posted sort of a job description for that position and had advertised it. And I think at the time that they had moved forward with advertising and posting for that position, Susan was starting to think about retiring and slowing down. And in particular, there were certain aspects of the job that as she got older, she just didn't love anymore. And so they were looking for Just a different set of voices. They were also interested in diversifying the faculty and the staff that supported the Love Foundation. And so the call to the job posting was forwarded to me by a colleague on Twitter, actually saying, you know, this isn't the right opportunity for me, but I thought of you, and had forwarded it to like five or six of us. And I read it. And at the time, I was starting to think about next steps for my own career. And I read it, and I think perhaps the most telling thing is that rather than deleting it outright, I read it. And then after I read it, rather than deleting it, I moved it to my one of my email file folders and just slid it into that folder. And then I just kept thinking about it. Probably 6 weeks passed and I did nothing, but I would constantly think like, God, that was such a great job description. And I just was really inspired by what they were looking for and their vision for growth and what the foundation really embodied and believed. And it aligned so closely with my beliefs that I finally ended up applying for the position. And did not tell my husband. And the position actually at the time, pre-pandemic, would have involved moving to LA. And at the time I was still in Kansas City. And so I applied for the position thinking like, there's no way they're going to hire me for this. And I got selected for like a pre-interview, and I had the pre-interview with the CEO, Christopher Clinton Conway. And it had been just absolutely delightful. We had had a wonderful conversation. And so then I got selected for this sort of final interview that was with the foundation board president and Susan and Christopher and a few other people close to the organization. And at that time, I felt like I probably needed to tell my husband that I was apparently interviewing for a job in LA. And I think his response was something like, do you know how much housing costs in LA? And I was like, yeah, but I just can't stop thinking about this. So I had that interview, and that was on Zoom, mostly because they were in LA and I was in Kansas City. And that was actually kind of pre-pandemic. So it was one of the first times that I had really used Zoom in that group interview format that now just seems like every single day of our lives, right? And I know that the group had scripted questions that they wanted to ask me. But instead, what happened was the first question Susan asked me got me so excited. And I think it was about, you know, patient communication and how I value that, and talking a little bit about some of the features that had stood out on my application. And Susan and I just very quickly, kind of rapid fire, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, had all these ideas about ways to be more effective communicators in healthcare, better reach different patient communities, all the different patient communities that really needed to be reached out to or included that perhaps had been historically suppressed voices or didn't have the same access to information, which led to talking about being disruptive in the clinical research industry and how often what we do with research is kind of the same old thing over and over again, different versions of the same experiment or slight iterations of the same drug or the same target, and how that there's a huge opportunity to revolutionize cancer care by really going in whole new directions to look for opportunities to cure the disease. And it was, no one else got to talk. I mean, Susan and I just had this absolutely lovely bringing together of minds. I can't describe it any other way. And I just felt so excited by her and her energy and connected to her. And then finally they told us that like, we really had to end our phone call. And I was like, but there's so much more I want to talk to Dr. Susan Love about. And so it was just absolutely amazing. And after that, the pandemic hit, and then all of a sudden the foundation, you know, was kind of sending me messages that said things like, you know, we love you, But we have no idea what's happening in the world right now, and we just need a minute. And so, actually, one of the first outings I had during the pandemic was the CEO actually came to Kansas City to meet me in person and talk about, what the opportunity might look like in this, at the time, peri-pandemic world. And they had essentially agreed to change the job position to this medical advisor position that would allow me to not move to LA and start working for a nonprofit in the middle of a pandemic, but instead have a close connection and relationship with the foundation doing many of the things that Susan and I had gotten so excited about on that original call. And so rather than taking a new job, I ended up with two jobs and I went to my friends and colleagues at Sarah Cannon, where I was at the time, and said, "Hey, is it okay if I take this other job?" And they said, "Absolutely." And so that ended up being a really great opportunity and how I got involved in the organization. And then now that I've moved to Brown, it was one of my first questions here is, can I keep being a partner with the foundation and being a medical advisor here? And they are gracious enough to let me to continue that other job that I have as well. And it's been wonderful.
Well, just wrapping up here, Dr. Graf. I know sadly we lost Dr. Love earlier in 2023. Is there, just to sort of end on that note, preserving her legacy, how are you going about doing that in regard to the breast cancer book and with the foundation, and how do you see her legacy continuing?
Yeah, I think that's a question that continues in evolution and is potentially happening in stages. So, interestingly, for everything that Susan is and was and forever will be, one thing that maybe she didn't want to be is a name attached to a book and a foundation forever and ever and ever. So, I do think that there's a vision to reimagine what the next steps look like, and that's definitely still ongoing. As of now, the new edition is launched, and myself and Lauren, the other medical advisor in the foundation, together have really taken on the helm of being the faces of the book and helping to promote it and share it its light out in the world. I'm so proud to do that with Hachette, our publisher, who are also have been tremendous champions of the book the whole journey of all the editions, and so continuing to see that. I don't know what will happen when it's time for the next edition, the eighth edition. I guess we'll have to see when the time is right to pursue that and what that reimagined version of the book looks like. In terms of Susan herself, the Love Foundation is partnering with the Harvard Radcliffe Institute, Schellinger Library to actually receive Dr. Love's papers. So, one of the archivists is going to go through all of Susan's, earliest drafts of the book and personal papers and research grants and all of that, and include that in their library's collection. So you will be able to visit Dr. Love's intellectual properties collection at the Harvard Radcliffe Institute Library. That library has a really just powerful collection of works by other historical giants that are women. And so I got to meet the archivist at the book signing that we held in Boston, and I'm really excited about going to see the collection once it's fully curated. I'm actually interested in introducing my daughter to the archivist because my daughter has a real passion for deep research and reading and quiet spaces and talking to the archivist. I actually think that this is her future career, right?
Wow.
So she her and I are planning a girls trip to go visit the Dr. Love's work once it's there, along with some of the other collections in the library. So that's just one example of the ways that I think Susan will continue to have an impact on the history of women in medicine and breast cancer and patient advocacy. Other components of the foundation, like the Love Research Army, continues to power forward, looking for opportunities to connect people interested in clinical research with trials that are appropriate for them or their communities.
Thank you for listening to the Cancer History Project podcast, podcasts of oral histories and interviews with the people who have shaped oncology as we know it. Our archives are available online for free at cancerhistoryproject.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @CancerHistProj. The Cancer History Project is a collaborative historical resource operated by the Cancer Letter. This is an ongoing project and would not be possible without the input and materials provided by our editorial board, our contributors, and the support of our sponsors, including Cedars-Sinai, Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and many others. View a full list of our sponsors at cancerhistoryproject.com/sponsors. If your institution would like to participate in the Cancer History Project, email us at admin@cancerhistoryproject.com.